It's time to check up on some of the top stories in national politics. Former Trump campaign chair Paul Manafort was found guilty of 8 counts of criminal fraud. And President Trump's former lawyer, personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, pleaded guilty to 8 crimes, including tax fraud and campaign finance violations. We're also going to look at a new anti-corruption proposal in the Senate and the national money that's expected to flow into Wisconsin's elections.
And we want to hear what you think about Paul Manafort's conviction and Michael Cohen's plea deal at 800-642-1234. Do you think it means President Trump has more to fear from the larger investigation into his 2016 campaign? Or do you think the investigation has gone too far? Tell us why. And do you think these cases will be politically costly for the president? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
Reed Epstein is a politics reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and he formerly wrote for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Reed, welcome to Central Time.
Great to talk to you guys.
So let's start with former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort. He was found guilty on 8 criminal charges yesterday. Specifically, what was he convicted of, and what kind of punishment could he be facing?
Well, Mr. Manafort faces decades in prison if he's convicted. He has another trial, federal trial, that's starting next month in Washington on a different sort of suite of charges that are a little bit more closely related to Russia. This trial that finished up yesterday was much more about his personal tax evasion and his various means that Mr. Manafort used and was accused of using of hiding income and funds that he income that he'd earned overseas in order to avoid paying American taxes on it.
And he was only found guilty on 8 of 18 counts. The other counts resulted in a mistrial. In the grand scheme of things, does this matter, and are these other charges expected to end back up in courts?
The prosecutors have not yet announced what they're going to do with the 10 charges in which there was the jury did not come to a verdict. Odds are they will wait until after his second federal trial is complete or adjudicated in some way before they determine whether they try him again. Typically, in these cases, if someone is convicted of a number of charges and faces a lengthy prison time, prosecutors tend not to opt for a second trial on charges where there was a mistrial.
President Trump did react to the Manafort verdict yesterday. Let's take a listen to him speaking with reporters outside of the White House.
It doesn't involve me, but I still feel, it's a very sad thing that happened. This has nothing to do with Russian collusion. This started as Russian collusion. This has absolutely nothing to do. This is a witch hunt, and it's a disgrace.
And there's the president saying that this doesn't involve him or have any connection between Russia and the 2016 campaign. And the president has used that term witch hunt over and over and over again. Does he have a point here?
Well, that has been the stance that the president and his defenders, both at the White House and outside the White House, have taken from the beginning on the Manafort trial, is that these were Manafort's issues alone. They didn't directly involve the president. And indeed, the judge in this case ordered the prosecution to not invoke the president's campaign or the various Russian implications in it during that trial. But the fact of the matter is Manafort was running the president's campaign for a stretch during 2016. And in fact, he has another trial coming up that's going to start in a few weeks, in which these issues of Russian collusion figure to be much more central to the prosecution against Mr. Manafort.
And those issues of possible collusion are of interest to special counsel Robert Mueller, and I would imagine Mueller may have some interest in talking with Paul Manafort a little bit further. Going forward, is there any talk of Manafort collaborating or working with Robert Mueller and perhaps offering up more information?
Well, that's what we don't know. And Manafort's decision, his decision on whether to cooperate with the special counsel may change now that he's looking at essentially spending the rest of his life in prison. We'll see. It's not entirely clear yet what he knows or what he has offered. Certainly he hasn't cooperated with the prosecutors so far. And as we saw today, the president on Twitter praised Paul Manafort for not cooperating with investigators, in contrast to Michael Cohen, his former attorney and sort of all-around fixer, who pled guilty in New York yesterday. And during his plea hearing, directly implicated the president in directing him to make payments to these women who have accused President Trump of having having affairs with them.
We are talking right now with Reed Epstein. He is a politics reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and we're talking about some of the top national political stories happening this week. And, Reed, you brought up Michael Cohen, and that's where I want to go next. As you said, he pleaded guilty to 8 crimes, including bank and tax fraud and campaign violations. And I think what caught people off guard was his willingness yesterday to implicate the president directly here. Maybe not referring to him by name, but saying like a candidate running for a federal office did this. And I think for a lot of people, this was a surprise because Cohen had previously said, you know, I would take a bullet for the president. He was kind of seen as the president's fixer. What changed for Michael Cohen?
Michael Cohen's had said, you know, over the course of this investigation into him, that he would put his family and his country first. His lawyer, Lanny Davis, who was last sort of on the national scene when he was President Clinton's lawyer during his impeachment proceedings, has said in various interviews today that Mr. Cohen's mind has changed on Trump, particularly after the episode in Helsinki, where he appeared to take the Russian side against United States intelligence services. Cohen is a sort of a classic example of someone sort of looking out for their own interests and cooperating with prosecutors in a way that's not helpful to the people who they used to work for. And this is a lot of times the way that prosecutors have turned people in all manner of investigations by they sort of had him after the investigators raided his office and got his documents. There wasn't much that they needed him to tell them because they had it all on paper.
And I want to take a listen to something that Michael Cohen's attorney, Lanny Davis, said this morning on Morning Edition. Here he is talking about the possibility of a presidential pardon for his clients.
I know that Mr. Cohen would never accept a pardon from a man that he considers to be both corrupt and a dangerous person in the Oval Office, and he has flatly authorized me to say under no circumstances would he accept a pardon for Mr. Trump.
Now, I seem to remember reports coming out prior to all this happening saying that Cohen was banking on a presidential pardon, and this is kind of a 180 from that. So does it sound like the relationship here between Trump and his former attorney is permanently destroyed now?
Yeah, I mean, a pardon was going to be unlikely for Michael Cohen after he said in open court that the president directed him to commit the crimes that he pled guilty of committing. It seemed the people who Trump has pardoned have been folks who have been Trump loyalists to the end. If you look at Joe Arpaio, the Arizona sheriff, Dinesh D'Souza, the conservative filmmaker, there's been a suggestion that he would pardon Paul Manafort. But the folks that have been in that discussion have been people who have been loyal to Trump, not clearly Michael Cohen. The loyalty is not what it was. And it would have been a significant surprise if Trump would have pardoned him after he essentially accused the president of committing a crime in open court.
Let's go to a caller now. Ted is with us in Monaco. Hi, Ted.
I think that your guest really hit the nail on the head. He seems to understand that when you get a skilled prosecutor like Bob Mueller, even Rosenstein, where you have a prosecutor a lot of experience but a shady past of criminal activity and having their things thrown out of court, and a prosecutor with no ethics, that they can squeeze someone to say anything, even force them to say something that isn't true or to exaggerate things to try to get out of your own sentence. Bob Mueller has wasted so much money. It's just amazing that he accepted this when he had such a conflict of interest and was in the back pocket of Hillary Clinton. And it's just amazing that you've got the media and the Democrats colluding and still sore losers that they lost the election. It's just amazing that the public doesn't, more the public doesn't see through this.
Ted, thank you so much for that call. Reed, do you want to respond to that?
Well, I mean, that's the position that the president and a lot of the president's supporters have taken, is there's not any real evidence that Bob Mueller, special counsel, is a partisan person. He was appointed FBI director by Republicans. And in fact, before he was appointed special counsel, he talked, President Trump interviewed him about being the FBI director. And so the argument that Mueller is compromised is one that is being pushed by the president, but is not really supported by a lot of people who are sort of even Republican, establishment Republican types here in Washington.
And before we switch topics, Reed, I want to ask, some Democrats have been more eager than others in the past to use the I word, and we're talking about impeachment. And I'm wondering, with the events of this week, if we're going to hear that call grow louder in the coming weeks, and if this is going to become a really big election issue for both Republicans and Democrats.
Well, I could tell you that Democratic officials in Washington do not want to talk about impeachment. They think that it's a political loser in the midterms. They see it as an issue that a surefire way to drive up Trump's base and get them to vote this November, a base that has been fairly depressed in the special elections and in primary elections that we've seen up to this point. But once the impeachment issue comes on the table, Democratic officials think that that is the best way to drive up Trump's base. Nancy Pelosi has urged Democrats to not talk about impeachment. And we've seen Steve Bannon, the former Trump campaign manager, who's since been ostracized from or sort of separated from the White House and from Trump, is trying to start a political organization to really push the idea that Democrats would aim to impeach the president if they win a majority in the fall, this November. I think what you hear from a lot of Democrats, Elizabeth Warren, I was at an event yesterday where she was asked this question, and they've taken the line that she articulated, which is that they're not going to entertain the idea of impeachment until after Mueller completes his investigation and delivers a report to Congress on what he has found.
And I know a lot of people have been eager for that report. Do we know anything, any timeline on when we could see results from the Mueller investigation?
We don't know. Mueller has not commented publicly on this since the beginning. His spokesman has offered no comments on essentially every story that has been written about this. And so, no, we don't know when it's. We don't know what else that they're working on. We don't know when it will conclude. We don't have any sense of whether this is the beginning or the end. You know, if you look at past cases like this, the Watergate hearings went on for more than 2 years before President Nixon resigned. The Whitewater hearings during President Clinton's presidency lasted for like 6 or 7 years. Iran-Contra during Reagan lasted for 6 or 7 years. This could be the beginning of the end or somewhere in between, and no one who's not inside the special counsel's office really has a sense of what the answer is.
We're talking right now with Reed Epstein, political reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and we are looking at some of the top political news stories of the week.
In a few minutes, we'll be talking about the national money that's expected to be spent on Wisconsin's fall elections, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about out-of-state groups or political networks supporting Wisconsin candidates? Do you think it makes candidates less responsive to state residents? Or does this just go with the territory and doesn't make that much of a difference? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
We'll pick up this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Reed Epstein, politics reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and we are looking at some of the top news stories out of Washington this week. And before we went to break, Reed, you mentioned Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren. She was busy this week, yesterday, proposing a wide-ranging bill aimed at tackling corruption in Washington. What kind of stuff was she proposing with this legislation?
Well, this was really, it felt in the room where she was giving the speech like the first event of the 2020 presidential campaign. Senator Warren introduced sort of a suite of anti-corruption efforts anti-corruption proposals. She would forbid federal officials from owning individual stocks. She would institute a lifetime ban on lobbying for members of Congress. And she would require the IRS to release tax returns, 8 years of tax returns for any presidential candidate and 2 years of tax returns for any candidate for Congress, in addition to releasing their tax returns every year they're in office. She also called for the creating of a new federal ethics agency to essentially serve as the watchdog on these issues, sort of an ethics version of the Consumer Financial Protection Board, which she, of course, was integral in starting during the Obama administration.
And to be clear, we've got a Republican-led Congress. This legislation is going nowhere, correct?
Of course. This is much more, this is not legislation that will be passed in this year or even in the next 2 years. But it's a marker for her to lay down as she is widely expected to start a presidential campaign sometime after November. We're seeing this from a number of people who are expected to be presidential candidates sometime early, as early as the end of this year or certainly in the beginning of next year. Kamala Harris, the senator from California, today introduced legislation to help stem maternal mortality rates among black women, which certainly is an issue that will resonate among Democratic primary voters, particularly in southern states, where in both 2008 and 2016, those were the voters that essentially picked the Democratic nominee.
And I'm wondering, too, there are a lot of proposals in here that would appeal, I would guess, to the more progressive wing of the Democratic Party. And it seems like right now, maybe the early presidential contenders are kind of trying to put their progressive chops out there for voters to kind of decide, while also trying to appeal to the more moderate wing of the Democratic Party. The Democrats are trying to figure out which direction they're in going forward. Is that something that any candidate, whether it's Warren or somebody else, is really going to have to balance going forward, that need to appeal to kind of both sides of the party at this point?
Well, one of the things about what Warren introduced is these proposals that she's talking about are broadly popular across the political spectrum. If you remember, Donald Trump in 2016 ran on a drain the swamp platform. And essentially that is what Warren's proposal would be to put teeth to that idea of decreasing the power of lobbyists, ending a revolving door between members of Congress and various corporations. A lot of that is stuff that Trump talked about during the campaign trail. He just has essentially done the opposite of that since he's been in office.
We're talking with Reed Epstein. He is a politics reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and we are talking about some of the top national political stories of the week. And we've just got a few minutes left here, but one story I wanted to touch on, Reed, is campaign spending here in Wisconsin. Our midterm races are set. We've got Democrat Tony Evers challenging Governor Scott Walker. We've got Republican Leah Vukmir. She's running against Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin. All across the country, there's a lot of money being spent on races. Here in Wisconsin, it's probably going to see a lot of money as well. But do you think that we're going to see just records amount of money pouring into races like this year?
I mean, the Wisconsin governor's race is probably will be, if not the most interesting governor's race in the country. It's certainly in the top three or four. You're going to see a lot of money in that race. On the Senate race, you've already seen like millions of dollars come in, particularly on the Republican side against Tammy Baldwin. You just had a primary that had essentially one billionaire against another between Kevin Nicholson and Leah Vukmir and their various billionaire backers. There is going to be far more outside money spent in both of those races than there is money that's raised and spent by the candidates.
I'm curious, too, the day after Tony Evers won the Democratic nomination here in Wisconsin, the Republican Party was already on the airwaves with attack ads, and I know the advertising wars aren't going to slow down anytime soon, but are we going to see more money being spent by the parties, or is this something where outside groups in particular are really going to have an impact here?
I think you're going to see all of the above. I mean, certainly Scott Walker has spent a long time building up a campaign war chest. Tony Evers, by the end of the primary, was effectively out of money. He had not raised that much money, not raised nearly as much money as Walker had to begin with. And so he's going to be largely dependent on groups like the Democratic Governors Association and various other outside groups liberal outside groups to help him on the air, at least for the next few weeks. Because as we've seen in the elections, that if you can define your opponent early, that it makes it very difficult for them to recover from that. And the danger for Evers is that he's not nearly as well known as Governor Walker at this point. And if there's an onslaught of advertising against him in August and September, if he's not able to answer that effectively or have his allies answer that effectively, it could make it difficult for him to recover as once early voting starts later in the fall.
And Reid, in our last minute or so, been an incredibly busy week in Washington, plenty of stuff that we weren't even able to talk about. What are you going to be watching for as this week goes on and into next week as well?
Well, certainly in Washington, we're always waking up early and looking to see what the president has tweeted. But next week, there's going to be the last two sort of major primaries of the primary season are going to be next Tuesday. There's a Senate primary in Arizona between three candidates who are all vying to be the most Trump-friendly Republican in the race. And there's there's governor's primaries in Florida on both sides of the ticket. The Republican primary, likewise, has a Trump-endorsed candidate, Ron DeSantis, a member of Congress, against Adam Putnam, the Florida's agriculture secretary. And that race has really come down to a test of Trump loyalty. And Mr. DeSantis has made his entire campaign about being loyal to Trump, while Mr. Putnam has tried to run on as somebody who knows Florida issues.
And we're going to have to leave it there. That was Reid Epstein. He is a political reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and he was getting us up to speed on some of the biggest stories out of Washington this week.